The former president of South Korea faces more legal challenges.
It's the first time an arrest warrant has been issued against a president of South Korea.
Donald Trump's choice for attorney general.
All I want to be is attorney general. That's it. That's what I'm focused on. I'm very determined. I'm driven. I'm a prosecutor.
And Americans remember their 39th president.
His dedication to helping other people, I think that's the primary purpose for all of us in our lives.
Today is New Year's Day, Wednesday, January 1st, and this is VOA's International Edition. Hello, I'm Steve Karish.
And I'm Alexis Strope. We begin today's show in South Korea with more on the political fallout from former President Yoon Suk-yeol's declaration of martial law in early December. On Tuesday, a court gave authorities approval to arrest the former president, even after he was impeached and suspended from power. Ryan Chang of Reuters has more.
It's the first time an arrest warrant has been issued against a president of South Korea. It's the latest turn in what's become the key U.S. ally's deepest political crisis in decades. Investigators allege Yoon led an insurrection, one of the few charges for which a South Korean president does not have immunity. The arrest warrant was issued by the CIO, or South Korea's Corruption Investigation Office for high-ranking officials, and was approved by a district court in Western Seoul. Yoon's lawyer, Yoon Gap-gun, spoke to media on Tuesday, arguing the warrant against his client is invalid.
I question whether the issuance of such an illegal warrant aligns with the principles of the rule of law. It is our position that this unlawful arrest warrant request is illegal and invalid. The declaration of martial law is a power granted to the president under the Constitution. The president exercised this authority legitimately as part of their duty to protect the constitutional order of the nation.
Yoon had already ignored summons for questioning three times since his martial law declaration. His supporters rallied outside his residence on Tuesday as they faced off with his critics, which included Jinbo Party lawmaker Chon Jun-dong.
Even regarding this arrest warrant, Yoon Suk-yeol, who is being accused of treason, claims that it is illegal and refuses to acknowledge it. Therefore, it's imperative today to ensure that this arrest warrant is executed and that this individual accused of treason faces legal consequences.
In a statement, South Korea's Presidential Security Service said it will treat the arrest warrant according to due process. Previously, the service had blocked police attempts to raid the presidential office as part of an investigation. Meanwhile, Yoon's impeachment trial is underway at South Korea's Constitutional Court. The next hearing in that case is set for Friday. When Yoon declared martial law on December 3rd, he mentioned anti-state forces were among his political opponents. He revoked it hours later after lawmakers defied him. Prime Minister Han Duck-soo had taken over from Yoon as acting president, but he too was impeached on Friday.
That was Reuters' Ryan Chang.
Also in South Korea, authorities say they're making all-out efforts to hasten the identification of human remains following the fiery plane crash there on Sunday. That's Lee Jin-cheol, administrator of the Busan Regional Aviation Administration. He says they've added personnel and are working through the night to shorten the process. Officials have also faced pointed questions about design features at the airport, particularly the placement of the large dirt and concrete embankment near the end of the runway that the skidding plane crashed into. It was built there to support navigation equipment. However, now investigators are looking into whether its location so close to the runway was against the industry standard for airport design.
And now to the Middle East. The overthrow of Syria's Bashar al-Assad regime has opened the door to new political dynamics in the region. Analysts say that with Iran on the back foot, Turkey is likely to be gaining influence. And with that, Iraq could be seeing more freedom from Iranian influence and pressure and possibly having new leverage. Dale Gavlak reports from Amman.
Regional analysts say the fall of the Assad government in Syria, spanning 54 years in power, first with the elder Hafez al-Assad and later son Bashar of the minority Alawite community, a branch of Shiite Islam, marks a seismic shift in Middle East politics. Sinan Ulgen, a senior fellow with Carnegie Europe, called the sudden fall of the brutal Assad government a political earthquake with far-reaching regional implications during a Carnegie Middle East Center webinar on December 19 in Beirut.
From fundamentally, we now see the emergence of a government in Syria that maybe after 50 years, really, is likely to be more pro-Turkey than more pro-Iran. This is a lasting change in the regional power constellation, which is yet another reason why the fall of Assad has been welcomed with such zeal in Ankara.
Ali Garameya, the deputy head of the Middle East program at the European Council on Foreign Relations, said Israel's defining attacks on Iran's influence over Assad and its assets in Syria, its Hezbollah proxies in neighboring Lebanon, and Israeli military strikes in the heart of the Iranian capital, Tehran, present a moment of regional reckoning for Iran.
It is definitely on the back foot. There is now a strategic rethink happening within the establishment about where their policies, both at home and abroad, go from here.
Garameya said that once prominent figures in Iran's powerful Revolutionary Guard Corps are likely to be replaced with others, given its now demoted regional status and the near demise of its so-called axis of resistance in Syria, Lebanon, Iraq, and Yemen. She said that Iran likely will spin a narrative that the late Revolutionary Guard commander Qasem Soleimani's regional project to surround Israel with a so-called ring of fire has been accomplished, and Iran will look to devise other plans to deal with the new reality it faces. While Harith Hassan, a non-resident senior fellow at the Carnegie Middle East Center, says Iraq is the last stronghold for Iran's axis of resistance. He notes that, too, could be changing in this new regional power dynamics.
So Iran might try to strongly defend that influence, but as we see that the balance of power has shifted a lot and the Iraqi government gained more freedom to be able to resist some of the pressure coming from Tehran.
Hassan said concerns about a possible Islamist-led government in Syria is giving pause for concern to its neighbors, as well as to regional political influencers Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates, that he said could give Iraq new leverage because of its long border with Syria and strong cross-border ties between the two countries. Hassan says that also may give Iraq a way out from under Iran's influence as developments in the region continue to unfold. Dale Gavlak, VOA News, Amman, Jordan.
For a deeper dive into the new reality of Middle Eastern politics, I spoke with Avi Melamed, a former Israeli intelligence officer and Arab affairs advisor. He's also the author of Inside the Middle East.
Well, yes. I mean, to a certain extent, of course, it's a different region, particularly when you talk about this story of the Iranian hegemonic vision. I would say that it would be accurate to say that we witness the end of the Iranian hegemonic vision, at least the way it has existed up until now. So this is, of course, a very significant dramatic change, because that story was one of the major engines that actually was kind of like dictating the beat of the region for the last couple of decades.
So what do you think will take its place?
I think that one of the things that we'll probably see, we see Turkey that is kind of like, of course, currently at least is gaining a lot of momentum. It can definitely mark itself a major achievement in the context of the competition with Iran and other players because of its involvement in Syria. And so I would expect that to result in, among other things, a growing momentum of Turkey in the region, particularly when you take into consideration that its president Erdogan has its own hegemonic vision, so to speak. I would say that this is one of the things that we could expect. Which I think also probably will fuel or refuel or reignite frictions that for the last couple of years kind of like were calmed down between Turkey and some major Arab states and Turkey and Israel. So we should definitely look closely at the story of Turkey and Erdogan.
That was my next question. Is a more powerful Turkey good for Israel?
When you look at Turkey under Erdogan, This is definitely something, and I emphasize under Erdogan, because it's a lot to do with his personality and his dominance. And we have a lot of experience, meaning the region has a lot of experience, including Israel. And most of that experience when it comes to Erdogan is not very good one, sort of speaking. He's very provocative. He's very cynical and very shrewd. He always looking for, issues and subjects to grab on to monetize in order to harvest political dividends. And we see it in the case with Israel, we see it in the case with Egypt and Saudi Arabia and others. So when it comes to Turkey, we have to think about Erdogan, particularly when we talk about Turkey.
Do you take the new Syrian leadership at their word when they say they don't want war with Israel?
I would say, I would add the word currently. It's quite clear that they don't have an interest at this moment to be engaged with any kind of collision with Israel. But that's the reason I'm saying the word currently. We have to remember in the end of the day that this is a rule that is rooted in a Sunni Islamic radical ideology, going back to ISIS and Al-Qaeda. We have to remember that as far as they are concerned and the international community is concerned, Israel is occupying parts of Syria. And also the fact that they are definitely, at least for now and in the foreseeable future, going to be massively supported by Erdogan. All those components in the end of the day obviously has the seed or the potential sometime in the future to result in a situation where we will see a confrontation with Israel. Currently, as I said, this is not their interest for obvious reasons, but it's definitely something that has the seeds for something like that to evolve later on down the road.
Avi Melamed is a former Israeli intelligence officer and a senior Arab affairs advisor. Mr. Melamed, thanks for joining me today on what's no doubt a very busy weekend.
Thank you. Have a good day.
And here are some more stories we're following from around the world.
A military appeals court has ruled against U.S. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin's effort to throw out the plea deals reached for Khalid Sheikh Mohammed and two other defendants in the September 11th attacks. The decision Monday night puts back on track the agreements that would have the three men plead guilty in exchange for being spared the possibility of the death penalty.
Thousands of people, led by students in Bangladesh, have called for the prosecution of ousted Prime Minister Sheikh Hasina and those responsible for hundreds of deaths in a mass uprising against her. Hasina fled to India on August 5th after weeks of violence in which authorities say hundreds of people were killed and thousands more injured on orders of her government. Last week, Bangladesh sent a formal request to India to extradite Hasina.
A blackout has hit nearly all of the U.S. territory of Puerto Rico just as residents prepare to celebrate New Year's. More than 1.3 million households and businesses were without electricity on Tuesday, and officials say it could take up to 2 days to restore power. Puerto Rico continues to struggle with chronic power outages, blamed on a crumbling power grid that was badly damaged by Hurricane Maria in 2017.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Alexis Strope.
And I'm Steve Karish. Switching now to American politics, President-elect Donald Trump is choosing some of his strongest supporters to be members of his cabinet. However, his selection for the nation's top law enforcer may face some tough questions over ethics and lobbying. VOA's senior Washington correspondent Carolyn Pursuti introduces us to Pam Bondi.
Prior to being Attorney General of Florida, I was a career prosecutor for 18 years.
Pam Bondi is best known as the first female Attorney General of Florida, the home state of Mar-a-Lago, which is the home of President-elect Donald Trump. Here's what Bondi told VOA in 2012 when she was first elected.
All I want to be is Attorney General. That's it. That's what I'm focused on. I'm very determined. I'm driven. I'm a prosecutor.
Bondi spoke at the Republican National Convention in 2016 when Donald Trump was the party's presidential nominee 3 months before he won the presidency.
I know Donald, and I am proud to know Donald.
Our votes are being suppressed.
As staunch loyalist, Bondi supported the false notion that Trump won the 2020 election. She was also on Trump's legal team during his first impeachment trial.
Joe Biden was the point man for Ukraine.
Along with other Republicans, Bondi spoke in support of the president-elect at his hush money trial in New York when he was found guilty of 34 felony counts.
Hi, everyone. Great meeting. Looking forward to seeing Senator Graham.
In early December, Bondi visited Capitol Hill, lobbying legislators in advance of her Senate confirmation hearing for attorney general, including Senator John Cornyn of Texas.
I want to make sure that we restore the reputation of these agencies, these departments like the FBI and the Department of Justice and the intelligence community, that we restore their reputation as non-political institutions.
Analysts say her lack of independence from the White House is a valid matter of concern. James Sample teaches law at Hofstra University, and Claire Finkelstein is faculty director of the Center for Ethics and the Rule of Law at the University of Pennsylvania.
There will be times, I think it is an absolute certainty, given the degree to which Mr. Trump is trying to push the envelope on so many legal fronts, where fidelity to law and fidelity to Trump will be in tension. And that is going to be a crucible for Pam Bondi to deal with.
One of her conflicts is that in 2013, her office decided not to formally investigate fraud claims regarding Trump University.
But the Florida Ethics Commission found no violation on her part.
Somebody that has always been there, former Florida Attorney General. She could have anything she wanted, by the way.
Bondi is currently with Ballard Partners, a Washington, D.C. lobbying firm. Analysts say senators will also ask about her high-profile clients, who could be plaintiffs before her as attorney general. Carolyn Pursuti, VOA News, Washington.
Staying in the United States, the Treasury Department was the victim of a major cyber attack earlier this month. Reuters' Freddie Joyner has the story.
The U.S. Treasury Department said Chinese state-sponsored hackers broke into its systems in early December, according to a letter to lawmakers obtained by Reuters. The Treasury called the breach a major incident, saying department workstations were remotely accessed and documents were stolen. It said the hackers compromised third-party cybersecurity service provider Beyond Trust, gaining access to a key used by the vendor, and were able to retrieve unclassified documents. Chinese Foreign Ministry spokesperson Mao Ning on Tuesday called the claims groundless and lacking evidence. A spokesperson for the Chinese embassy in Washington also rejected any responsibility for the hack. The Treasury Department said it was alerted to the breach by Beyond Trust on December 8th, and that it was working with the U.S. Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency, as well as the FBI, to assess the breach's impact. Treasury officials did not immediately respond to an email seeking further details about the hack.
Freddie Joyner of Reuters reporting for us.
In Ukraine, as winter descends, UNICEF and other aid organizations are helping communities in the Kharkiv region prepare for the cold days and frigid nights. Many residents have lost their jobs and incomes because of the war and can't afford heating. Among them is the Maliki family, whose two children have disabilities. Anna Kostachenko has their story.
I need two of these buckets to heat my place. I put the firewood in the stove in the morning, and it lasts until the evening.
In Irina Malakay's house, this small wood boiler is the only heat source. It requires nearly constant feeding with firewood. Malakay lives with her husband and three children in the city of Derhachi, in eastern Ukraine's embattled Kharkiv region. Her 8-year-old daughter Angelika has developmental delays. Her 13-year-old son Svetoslav was diagnosed with diabetes in the summer of 2023.
Because of the war, there are issues with medications running out or being hard to find. This summer, we had to travel to Kupiansk to get the medicine we needed because it was not available elsewhere in Ukraine.
Her husband provides for the whole family. A tailor, he takes orders whenever he can, while she, a seamstress by profession, is trying to find work.
I'm taking orders home when I can, but there aren't many. When people hear I'm in Derhachi, they get scared. They say, with all the shelling there, we can't risk going all the way there.
In 2023, the children's aid organization UNICEF provided the family with financial aid and hygiene kits. This year, it is assisting with winter preparations in the Kharkiv region, says Pavlo Pershin, an emergency response officer for UNICEF's Kharkiv office.
Well, initially we plan to provide in-kind assistance to families with children that are residing in 0 to 30 kilometer area. However, due to the deterioration of security situation, military security situation, most of the families with children in certain hromadas like Kupenska, Borivska had to be evacuated.
Employees from the Peaceful Heaven of Kharkiv Charity Foundation helped deliver briquettes to local communities despite the constant risk of shelling, says coordination manager Volodymyr Akshentsev.
There have been cases when, unfortunately, our employees were hit, so we have to pay more attention to safety. Sometimes you plan everything, develop a route, but it gets canceled for safety reasons.
Akshentsev says that recently aid workers in the Kharkiv region were struck and killed by a Russian drone.
They were attacked by a drone. They had a white van marked with signs indicating that it was humanitarian aid. It was impossible to confuse it with a military vehicle.
Despite the daily risks, Peaceful Heaven continues to deliver briquettes. A UNICEF's winter aid targets 16,000 families in the Kharkiv region, with 9,000 receiving financial aid, and some 3,000 having already received heating briquettes that will help keep them warm this winter. Anna Kostyuchenko, VOA News, Kharkiv region, Ukraine.
And finally today, Americans remember President Jimmy Carter following his death on Sunday at 100 years old. VOA's Scott Stearns reports.
Outside the White House, where flags are flying at half-staff, Californian Cheryl Jones says Jimmy Carter was her favorite president.
He was just a good man, a decent man, an honest man, something we don't see very much of anymore.
Kit Burns, a resident of the Washington State city of Tacoma, best remembers Carter for his work building homes for people in need.
There's a number of Habitat for Humanity housing near where I live. And his dedication to helping other people, I think that's the primary purpose for all of us in our lives. And it's terrible. The state of the world is where we're not helping people. And he set such an example for so many years.
Carter showed the importance of caring about people, says Virginia Natosha Walker.
You're a public servant. You're here to serve people. So that's the most important quality. And leading by example. You know, he had Bible study, he did Habitat for Humanity. Those are all good examples of how we should lead and how we should interact with our fellow Americans.
The New York Stock Exchange held a moment of silence for the former president before its opening bell Monday. New Jersey resident Dolores Spivak remembers Carter's work with Israelis and Palestinians.
I am so in awe of him. I'm in awe of his presidency because he was the one who fought for the environment, civil rights. But afterwards, his books that he wrote, especially on the Mideast, were tremendous. I get chills when I talk, when I think about the Camp David Agreement.
Carter's death is an opportunity to learn more about his life and presidency, says Connecticut resident Kim Potvin.
I think a lot of the policy that he was involved with that I wasn't aware of, and also just kind of the economics and history of that time. So I always think that we learn a lot from history because it translates a lot to present day.
In Carter's hometown of Plains, Georgia, Sandra Walters remembers a friend who grew up across the street.
Thank you, Lord, for letting him live 100 years and do all the things that he wanted to do. And I think he accomplished so much that who could be sad over anybody who had done what that man had done from a little town in Plains, Georgia, raised on a peanut farm and became the president of the United States.
Carter will be buried in Plains after a state funeral in Washington on January 9th. Scott Stearns, VOA News.
And that'll wrap it up for today. This has been International Edition on the Voice of America.
On behalf of everyone here at VOA, thank you for joining us.
For pictures, stories, videos, and more, follow VOA News on your favorite social media platform and online at voanews.com.
In Washington, I'm Alexis Strope.
And I'm Steve Karish. Thanks for listening, and Happy New Year.